Okay, I have a proposal. My proposal is this. I think that you introduce Billy. Billy introduce Nathaniel, and Nathaniel introduce Malcolm.
Oh, that's a perfect idea.
That work for y'all?
Okay.
Are you ready to go first, Malcolm?
Just trying to see how to navigate putting that all into a short spiel. I can do it. Gotcha. All right, so Billy is an awesome musician, has a amazing personality, funny comedian, known him since James Monroe Elementary. Probably, if not Nathaniel being up here, the second choice would always be Billy.
Love. Hey man, thank you. I just want to give it back and say bless you, brother. I know you're gonna get your intro soon, but it's so hard not to speak and talk on that. But I want to give a real just a genuine love for this young man. I think one time he seen us on a not really like on the streets, but my family, me and my wife was walking, and him and his wife just gave us $50, man. Then took us out to dinner. That's the kind of heart this man got. But I've known him for since Upward Bound. That's a college thing that you're in high school, you go to college and you get the college experience. So this brother is just a loving, ready to fight, go in with you, but also fighting and loving the Lord too. Give it up for Pastor Nathaniel Curtis. He ain't gonna tell you that, but I'll tell you. There it is.
Chill. I appreciate that, Billy. The man in front of me right now, Malcolm Jones, best friend since kindergarten, go all the way back to Ghent Elementary, rocking and rolling since that, with the high school together. Probably one of the best guys I know in the world. Passionate about community, passionate about families, passionate about helping out people. Just one of the realest people on the planet, man. So it's great to be at the table with everyone here. Yeah.
Didn't see me slide him $50, but
yeah. He did not slide me 50, but I want it for real.
Real family, real family, man. Real family.
How old were y'all when you all met?
Well, he knew Malcolm knew D'Angelo beforehand, so they in elementary. I met him at elementary school.
But y'all met in
kindergarten. We met in kindergarten, but did you do the pre-K program at James Monroe? Because I was at James Monroe first.
Did
And
you
then
do
I went
Mama, I Want to
over.
Read program?
I did that too.
I was
So we
saying
probably
Mama,
met.
yeah. And then it's a picture of you at a fifth grade graduation.
Yeah, I came over to James Monroe in second grade.
Okay.
So from second grade, I was there for pre-K, and then from second grade all the way to kindergarten. Then I went to Blair, then I went to Maury.
Because you had a rat tail, bro.
Yeah. He did. You had the
Did I have a
coochie.
rat
You
tail?
did. You had the rat tail on the back.
I
Yeah,
did
you
for a
did.
short period of time.
Yeah.
For a very short
I ain't
period of
gonna lie, I
time.
had my joint way too low.
You did have yours way too
I
low.
went back to my family house in Louisiana. It was like, yo, we gotta cut that. This is
Dang.
1998, bro. Why are you
Dang,
sliding?
man. Hey, not eight.
Way too low, man.
No, see, but
It
I
was
met.
like this low, man.
I
Wow.
need to understand the culture behind a rat tail. Like, why did you let one little piece of my hair grow 3-4 inches
Yeah,
in order to braid
out of
it?
every.
And the rest of my head
It
had
was
no hair.
Right.
I don't understand the
Like,
long, Jay.
looking like the little pharaoh from what's that?
Who's Golden Child?
No, the movie, the Moses movie.
Oh, Prince of Egypt.
No, the one that came on every Christmas or every Passover.
Oh, the 1961
joint.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot the name of it. We do all these
But you know
shows.
how he had a little
He's
thing on
doing
the
on the side.
side.
Yeah.
The Pharaoh joint.
Yes.
Were you also living in Lambert's Point or Park Place?
Yes. Park Place. I stayed on the other, he stayed on the closer, the 34th Street closer to Hampton Boulevard, right? Like,
Later on in
late,
life.
Later on in life.
I was on 26
26. Okay.
For until second grade, and in second grade we moved to 34.
So look, bro, so I met you, the thing I met you at
Upward Bound.
Upward Bound?
Yep, 10th grade, I believe.
10th grade?
Yep. Might have been ninth. Could have been ninth.
Yeah.
In between that summer.
Yeah, golly.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And it was just like
we just clicked.
Yeah, man.
It was crazy.
This is the brother, man.
Yeah.
How would you describe Park Place at that point when you were a child?
Oh, man. It was kind of before the gang started coming in, but it was just still, it was always a neighborhood, a hood, like you just got everything. I mean, it was, to me, it was fun because I had a lot of the kids and to play with, but some of the teenagers that was a little bit older were like losing their life because you know, either probably doing some selling drugs or doing, you know, into just some just the street life. But Pop Place has always been predominantly black when I was growing up. Before then, my generation, it was all white, you know, the white flight type of thing. But yeah, Park Place has been just a pretty cool place going, you know, had to definitely come in before the streetlights. But yeah, that was just interesting to grow up there, man. I think a lot of people that's from Park Place and from that part, the era that I grew up in, I think if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere in the world.
That's real.
Yeah, like the resilience and just, you know, they're going to test your fight. You know, especially if you got younger siblings, you're going to always get tested, and you can't come out the weakling because you got siblings that you got to look out for. Both. So, yeah, it was nice. It was a very community built. Like, you know, we had the multi-purpose center over there where the rec center was. So you had your doctor, you had your dentist, you get your shots. You know, welfare was over there as well. They had the Mama I Wanna Read program in the public. You can vote.
Wick as well.
Yeah, so it was kind of a nice hub that I don't think I see a lot of that going on that right now. So yeah, the library, the public library, was right in the there, same place. So
right next to James Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. Did you say you were there before there were streetlights?
No. We had to be in the house before the streetlights come on.
We
had the cell phones. We just at least had to check in.
Yeah, that street light come on, you know it. Yeah. But to make your way back home.
Yeah, let me check in. Like, Mom, home, is it all right if I can at least play a little bit around this part of the street?
One last game.
Malcolm, you were living in the same neighborhood. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yeah, for the most part. I think I might have saw some gang activity before, like at the younger age. There was a lot of stuff going on. I think in second grade when I came back to the school, I made friends with someone and they had lost their brother, like two streets up from the school. So there was a lot of stuff going on even at a really young age. Really, I mean, when I was living on 26th Street, I could look out the window and you could really see every social ill known to man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You had an alcohol, ABC store down the street, funeral homes throughout the neighborhood, some predatory businesses, like similar to like checking the cash and things like that. So you kind of had all of those different things. I saw a bottle fight between a man and a woman take place right outside of my apartment complex. And it's like, it's difficult because you hear yelling, you hear screaming, you hear glass breaking, you hear rocks being thrown and stuff like that. Parents tell you not to look out the window, but as a kid, you're curious because it's like, what's going on outside? So you want to kind of peek out the window. And even like when they were shooting outside, it's like, you should get down on the floor.
Yeah,
but as a kid, you're like really, really young kids. They're so curious about what in the world's going on. They're like oblivious to the fact that something dangerous could be going on because their whole world is butterflies and rainbows. And even though what was going on outside was going outside, most kids still have that innocence. So it's like, I had to stop some of my younger brothers from running up to the windows and looking out because you don't know whether it's fireworks or whether it's gunshots.
That's true. Hey man, I much respect. I think at that time it was a lot more like a lot more programs for youngins to try to be involved with, like the Rec Center Buster at the Rec Center, or we had a Boys and Girls Club
definitely
in the neighborhood. Now that's an apartment complex, so you know. But Park Place is just a very interesting place to grow up in. Yeah. And not to pound on the violence and stuff, but I just remember those, you know. I remember looking at an ice cream truck, but it ain't had no music. I'm like, what's going on? All right, okay, what's going on here? And they raided the apartment building across the street. I'm like, do you see the SWAT team come out? Everybody on the ground like, man, I just wanted to buy some popsicles, but I understand.
That wasn't the truck to go up to.
That wasn't the truck to go to right
But
there.
Just to speak on what you were speaking on, there was a lot of great things. I have a lot of good memories in my childhood, especially at the Boys and Girls Club. Mm. You could do a lot of things at the Boys and Girls Club, art, music, computer, swimming. Science, swimming, basketball. Like, there was, and then you had good family restaurants in the area that you could go to for lunch. You had King Snowball, Quick Pickup. What's the other place? Part food.
Yeah.
So it had its low lights, but it also had a lot of great highlights. So
And when you said about the funeral home, it used to be a funeral home on 35th Street. The guy seen us play what they call Chinese knock. You know, you knocking on people's doors and you run. You knock on the door and everything. And the dude seen us, right? He said, "Hey man, come on over here. I want to catch y'all." It was about four or five of us, and he took us into our funeral parlor place, and then he took us like downstairs. And he showed us his body, like a dead body in the cast. He's like, now, this guy was out doing, he's about a little bit younger, older than y'all. But him getting caught up and stuff, and now I got to clean him up and put him in a suit, and now his family got a view. Now, you keep doing.
Community field trips.
Yeah, that was the community field trip. So if you want to end up in dead or jail, you need to stop what you're doing and do the right thing. It made me think, like, yo, there's much more to life than this. Yeah. So, I mean, it was just.
I'm sure he had great intentions, but it sounds very traumatizing.
Yeah, man, that's a lie, man. In the suit, he's like, bro, man, I think I just saw him about a couple weeks ago. He gone? He here?
For Ding Dong Ditch?
Nah, he just said, this is the reason if you going to keep messing around and playing around with your life, you going to end up like
How old were you?
Man, we had to be about eight. Stop
playing around at eight.
But respect was a little bit.
Man.
The criteria for respect was a little different in the 90s than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, if someone does that today, they might be in jail. But back then, it was a good conversation in the community.
But you're eight, though. Like, why would you say, like, you can't run at eight? Like, stop playing around and get your life together.
Community had so many different things going on, and we was exposed to so much that dialogue was appropriate for it. Considered appropriate for an eight-year-old because of everything that was going on in that neighborhood.
It changed my mind. I'm like, I don't want to be dead or in jail. I want to do something different.
For Ding Dong Ditch.
Let me go knock on this last door.
That's wild.
And I ain't doing it no more. But bless it, man.
Did you ever notice the dust, the coal dust, growing up?
We always been dirty and playing outside and smelling like outside. So
did outside smell like?
You know, when it smell like you just. Best friends with the sun. It's a smell that your parents only know when you come in. You're like, boy, you smell like outside. What is?
So
I see it on my kids sometimes.
Give you the imagination of what he just described, you're outside baking in the sun for about 5-6 hours because nobody wants you to come in until the lights. Till the street lights come on.
Because there ain't no in and out going.
You're drinking from the water out of the hose.
Yes.
Or turning on some the random
faucet.
House's faucet and drinking.
Yeah.
Going back and forth between the Boys and Girls Club, the multi-purpose center, Quick Pickup, and all these different hubs around the neighborhood.
And collecting cans to try to give to the candy lady. So then if you collect the cans, she'll trade you like a soda or a drink.
Candy bag.
Or the candy bags. That was our.
So we was out there doing probably labor out in the sun, and you would smell like it by the end of the day. You go take a shower, you get ready to eat dinner, you go to bed, you wake back up.
You do it
and
again.
And do your 6 hours again.
So that's that smoke and smog that you. The dust that you asked about, I don't know. It probably was dirt dust, but when you're talking, talking of the train and the cold, that's correct. Yeah. So we're in Park Place, and Park Place maybe a couple of streets up from the Lambert's Point area. So, and seldom, I mean, we had our rival football and basketball games and with Lambert's Point, and so we meet on that field sometimes over there by Madison and 35th Street. So, man, I probably couldn't test this question because I really couldn't tell you. I just was a dusty man.
That's fair.
Yeah. Well, I saw the trains and I saw the coal on top of the trains, but I never saw it as a health hazard or something that could potentially be hurting my health. You're going into Lambert's Point, like you said, competing against friends or hanging out. And with all the other things going on, you're kind of oblivious to an environmental danger when you're worried about physical violence, you're worried about drugs and all the different social ills going on in the community. You're a child trying to have fun, and you don't really imagine that your neighborhood could be providing potential dangers in the form of environmental because you're living paycheck to paycheck trying to make do. So I think for a lot of people in those both of those communities, it doesn't become a reality or a fear because you have so many other stressors and other problems and other priorities in life that an environmental one is just so far removed from your head. It can't even register. So as an adult now, registering that and thinking about that, it's like you ran outside, like you said, spent about 5 or 6 hours outside, probably inhaling it and being up in that sunbathing and all of those things, and was just completely oblivious to the environmental dangers, maybe 16, 15, 200 feet away from you.
Is that something you ever think about now as an adult? Like, was I exposed as a child to those things?
I mean, from talking to you all, it made me realize, like, oh, wow, was I actually inhaling this? It, like, so it opened up some awareness. But as a child, no, I always knew the difference between our railroad tracks. Like, you know, on this side of the railroad tracks, it's tough, it's rough. And on the other side, you got Colonial Place and, you know, that same train going towards over there at the depot or something, over there at Lambert's Point and whatnot, you know, over in that area. So it just passed through. So that's the only difference I knew, like, to understand that on this side of the tracks is a little different from the other side. But I wasn't aware until you all reached out and let me know the thing was telling me. I said, man, I never really thought about that. But I think about some of the friends that grew up in that area that probably sometimes maybe connected to certain crimes or maybe it did something psychological to them to have them resort to crazy jail. I don't know, but I wasn't aware until being informed of it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Do you have asthma?
No.
Do you know anybody with asthma? Or did you know anybody growing up with asthma?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Was it kind of common?
You know, playing football, hey, man, hold up. You know, that's like, man, that thing's so cool. You can blow smoke through your nose after you do that. That is like the only like type of connection. Just the seeing somebody say, hold on, man, let me get my inhaler. So,
yeah.
Oh, he got asthma, man. I can't run that fast, man. I got asthma, man. No, much love to anybody with asthma, yo. So,
Yeah, growing up, my sister had asthma, so she had a inhaler and all of those different things. So now, thinking back to all the different activities we would go to and all the areas we were in, kind of makes me think whether or not those kind of things had an impact or played a part in it. But it's really difficult for a lot of those different communities to kind of think about having asthma and then thinking about where it's coming from, because it has a lot of different environmental conditions happening, like in some of the apartment complexes, people were dealing with black mold. So it's like, I think a lot of people had a bunch of different issues and a bunch of different problems sitting right there, and it's like a conglomerate of different environmental and just different things that are definitely attacking your health and you don't even know about it.
I mean, and then every time I sometimes think about the mental, or you know, a lot of children maybe dealing with with IEPs or special education around in that area, you know. You're like, man, was it, you know, like you said, the mold in somebody's house or somebody lead, it was a lot of things about the lead poison. Mm-hmm. Or you're like, man, but what the effect of the smog, or could that been some type of an effect on some of these kids, you know, that's dealing with some either mental deficits or something. So try to put that together, like maybe, but like you said, you don't really think about it because you're dealing with a lot of other things going on. So,
and I think a lot of people chalked up certain behaviors to certain neighborhoods and certain neighborhood cultures, but really didn't think about all the different things, the trauma, the environmental, food shortages. Like, there's a lot of psychological factors that could be impacted by all the different things that are going on, like in these neighborhoods and what people are dealing with. So, yeah.
What's it like being back in Norfolk? Or did you ever take time and live anywhere else?
Well, I mean, I stayed in California for a couple months, and always traveled from across the East Coast to visit family, summer times and whatnot. But Norfolk has always been, lived in Virginia Beach for a little bit, but Norfolk has always been my home. So a lot of people from here, like, they say, yeah, man. A lot of people we grew up with, they're like, they moved to Virginia Beach. And it's like, okay. That's, you know what I mean? That's the stigma I always get from folks that's from here. Yeah, man, I moved to Virginia Beach.
You made it.
Technically, it is making it, because a lot of people, when you see so many people not even make it out of the neighborhood because of death and all the different things that going to jail, this, that, and the third, like leaving a place where you saw a bunch of different social ills, like you consider it a victory. Like now as adults, like knowing that there's so much other world to explore, some people haven't even been out of the country, let alone the state. Yeah, so it's
that's real.
Just knowing that I made it out of this area alive and in good health, or maybe in good health, and just kind of dealing with the things that you're dealing with now. It's like Virginia Beach is way different than Park Place in the 90s, Lambert Point in the 90s, Norview in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Like, it's way different.
And now, you know, you look at it now, I got to tell people, they be like, man, where you grew up? Like, Norfolk. What part, man? Park Place in the 90s, man.
Yeah, not the
Don't
same.
Think about the Park
the
Place.
Gentrified Park
yeah,
Place.
Nah, man. Don't think about the Park Place now, man. Park Place in the 90s. So, I mean, it's a lot of pride that goes in being from Norfolk, for real.
Tell me about what's changed.
Anybody want me?
Bike lanes, free Wi-Fi, coffee shops,
breweries. God bless them.
Right. Restaurants that are, you know, regional restaurants are in the area. What else I've seen that's just houses that used to be $100,000 or $90,000 and now $250,000, $300,000.
Come on.
It doesn't make any
sense.
And
I know for some listeners that might seem like this sounds like an amazing experience, this is what people look for in their community. But it's like when you lived in a community and then you leave a community, whether from gentrification, moving, or whatever the case, and then come back to it and it looks 20 times better, 20 times safer and more convenient. Like, and you feel like you're robbed of that experience because you never got to experience a safe version of what was home for you for so long. So to come back to a place that's now safe and looks like your kid can play outside without gunshots and all the crazy stuff, it's like you should take pride in how it looks and how great it is, but it's like you feel like, dang, I got robbed of a safe childhood where I could go outside and play and just enjoy life. Like, I've never going out there and seeing so many flags on houses.
Yeah.
It's like that's not a staple that you typically see in a black community. And it's not to say that we don't have some African Americans who are proud of America, but it's like when you're living in that environment where you see all these crazy things happening, it's really difficult to be proud because you don't feel like you have everything that you feel like you should have to feel like you fully took advantage of the American dream. Mm-hmm.
And what they're building now is not, I mean, it's not made for, I don't feel like it's made for the people, not saying original folks that was there, because originally was white and colonial place was black, or, you know, Ghent was a little bit more, was black, you know, and how they moved them out. And that's another story.
Right.
But being in Park Place and under and seeing what it's doing now and how, like, I remember they said the boys and, like, going to do something with the Boys and Girls Club, but now it's an apartment complex, which, you know, it used to be something for the youth and people can gather and go there. Now you take that out and it's like, you know, what the kids can do now, we got to outsource again. They say we're going to make a YMCA, which is great, and we're going to employ a lot of the people from the neighborhood. I applied. I definitely didn't get a job there. Yeah. And some other people.
Yes.
And even some of the breweries and things that they make there, I'm like, what about hiring the people that's been living there? Like, you know, we just made the consume or just buy stuff from but it's not a lot of...
Yeah. It's almost like Waterside. Like, growing up, Waterside was made to feel as though it was an environment that anyone could come and enjoy, but as a black person in Norfolk, you didn't feel welcomed at Waterside. Like, you felt like you were going to get harassed by police officers. You felt like you weren't going to be able to enjoy yourself. If you liked the trendy clothes that we liked, the baggy clothes at that time frame that we were going places, like, you would be discriminated against because of what you liked clothes-wise, because they were equating that clothes to a thug or a criminal or something like that.
Always.
So, and then also in Park Place community, it's like a lot of the things that they said and the way they went about things didn't feel comfortable or community-oriented. A lot of times when people say a house feels like a home, the home, it becomes a home because of the people in it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I felt about the community. Park Place was Park Place, not because someone named this chunk of land Park Place, but the people that was in it, the community feel. Yeah. So it's like when the community completely changes and the people who kind of made that community what it was aren't really invited back, or it's kind of pushed to the side, that community doesn't feel like your community anymore. And the Boys and Girls Club, we were told that they were going to do something with it, and they pulled us to the scope and asked us what our ideas were about changing it and fixing it. And they sat down, they fed us, they told us they were going to bring us a bunch of different ideas for how to make Norfolk better, and they didn't give us the thing that we asked for, which was give us our community center back. They said that it had asbestos and you wouldn't be able to turn it into anything else. It had to be demolished. But then it's an apartment complex. It's an apartment.
Hope y'all don't got asbestos over there.
Yeah. But even with the YMCA, like, they said they were creating a YMCA, but then you put this big old gate around the YMCA, so you don't make it feel inclusive because you make it seem as though this is the YMCA, but you feel like it's not your YMCA because we put this big old tall gate around it. It's kind of like the Trump gate on the beach. This is definitely a clear barrier, and we don't want certain people going over that barrier. Mm. So it doesn't feel accessible. It doesn't feel inclusive. It doesn't feel like it's for me.
Man. So I really would like to dive deeper in, and I wish I did way more research to see what does it do psychologically? What has it done? Because it's a lot of stuff that's been going on, and it's like, you don't know it until, just being real, but just to understand how did that affect our neighborhood and environment, our people, our mindset, man. You know, the
coal dust,
man.
And even our doctors weren't asking us those kind of things. They weren't going out and doing environmental checks to see what we were dealing with. They were just at the community center. Is just an affordable way to get checkups and to get your immunizations and physicals, to make sure you had the bare minimum and the bare essentials of healthcare. And we were just kind of glad to be able to get the bare minimum. So,
Man. So y'all all still live in the area.
Yeah.
And I know that you, for several reasons, chose Newport News, but also like your wife is based there and like has deep history there. But I wonder for both of y'all, like, do you ever wish that you could move back to Park Place area? Or is that something that you've considered?
I was looking at a house out here, trying to get it. But like I said, golly, I don't really have $400,000, $350,000 for a house that I know my phone boy Dominique used to live here. And now it was ran down. I mean, oh yeah, pick it up. But now it's like I can't really afford to live in the neighborhood that I want to live in, my neighborhood I grew up in. Well, just
better yet, you're not able to afford what you were able to afford 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah,
the same neighborhood, same place where you were already living. So
it's like it's got to be grandfather and like your father and your mother still own their house out there.
Yeah. But they still get postcards every summer offering to buy the house and buy the property. So,
how does that make you feel?
Like, man, what can I do to get some more money? Because that's the only thing that talks.
Yeah.
You know, it really is like, man, what I have to do? Like, how is this, you know, and it's not a lot of my folks that's buying. And if you don't know, I am a black man, people. So I just want to let y'all know that. But it's not a lot of my people buying these houses out here. It's like maybe somebody's a light. You know, I'm not hating on that, but they're just in a position. And
it's called gentrification for a reason. It's happening. It's people who are more affluent coming into a neighborhood that is impoverished or historically impoverished and being taken over. And it locks out people who've been there, who had roots there for generations, and now they no longer have access to the same place that they once called home. And you had the sweat equity, you lived there for a long time, and now, you know, now other people are reaping the benefits of these places that you no longer have. So it's sad. I'm listening to you like, hey, like, yeah, you lived in Alejandro. Yes, you lived in Park Place. Yes, you lived in this area. And now you can't even get back to it.
And it's bittersweet, though, because it's like a lot of times when you're living in it and all the social ills are there, like you were saying earlier about moving to Virginia Beach, it's like our culture has kind of deemed us that if you're living in a bad neighborhood, get as far away from it as possible. But it's like no one's coming out there and educating people to just build back up or to do things, create businesses, or do what you have to do within the community. And I'm not saying that's an easy challenge. It's just not easy at all when you're impoverished. But it's like if more people could find a way to stay in the neighborhood and build up within the neighborhood, which is definitely extremely tall task. But it's like no one was coming out there and offering you grants or loans or different things to help you build back up your community and to get it together so that you could maintain what you have. A lot of times we were educating people to leave and exit and run from the problems instead of cleaning up and fixing the problems and doing all those things.
Yeah, like imagine us as brothers with our family living in Park Place and raising our family in Park Place, being a symbol, a role model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what your family was when they was out there. Yeah. That's like a real solid family, like mother and father and brothers and family. And I didn't even, when I was looking at houses in Park Place and even in Lambus Point, I got something. I understood it's business, it's investors that lock these houses up.
Oh, yes.
And they get big businesses.
Yes.
And buy these homes.
Yep.
I know your wife. I know y'all know about that.
Yes, I've seen it. They're, I can't remember the name of the corporation that's doing it right now.
BlackRock?
No, Zillow was doing it. Yeah, so Zillow has all the access to all the database. And so they have purchased all these properties. Because then they buy up the block. And then they buy another piece of that property, like let's say 9 out of the 10 properties, they buy at a reasonable value. And the 10th property they buy just a little bit higher. And they bring up the value of those other houses. And then they resell it. And or they They rent it out to other people. That is, so like the value, like people can't buy houses that nobody could have because they're outpricing the area, and or they're just renting to individuals and of course charging them more than what the property owner value is worth. And so like you look it up, Zillow's been doing that over the past, you know, 3-4 years.
It ain't no way for a hardworking person to just
take up roots, live in the neighborhood, grow with the neighborhood. You know, my wife likes to say as a realtor, it's like rent always goes up, mortgages just stay the same. So would you want to keep your mortgage the same for the next 30 years? Mm-hmm. You can live in the neighborhood afford and grow into that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Rent, they'll every 12 months, up $100, up another $100. Yep. And your cost of living or your salary may not even go up. It's not going up with the cost of living. So people are being locked out of the American dream. What was supposed to be an American dream for some.
And now you're going to put some chemicals and coal in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
How? Why? Why keep us down like that?
Yeah.
It's even, you know what I'm saying? I'm just dang, that's crazy.
It makes you frustrating. Here are the things that you guys listed out already. Talk about the criminal element, the mental health aspect, the trauma that you face, the food disparity, all the stuff, and then you compound it with environmental injustice.
Yeah,
it almost seems unfair. And then now, once again, you know, look where we're at now.
What in the world? It's I really.
But then, if you go back to the gentrification of Lambert's Point, a lot of people who sat in that community and held coal for a long period of time have now been moved. So it's harder to track down individuals who might have had some health conditions or different things, impacts from that coal dust. Like, you would literally have to track those people down and try to figure out if they have those conditions and problems to even bring them here to educate them on something that may or may not have been educated on, and then see if the symptoms have a semblance with the environmental thing. So it's like, even if you do discover the real problems came and existed from the coal, now you got to figure out all of these people who used to live there who either scattered out of the state, out of the country, out of the area, out of the city, and locate those people to even let them know what they were possibly put at risk of. So it's just a bigger
Is that in some way coming to a way of I know as a child you think about acid rain and all this stuff. You know, and the cycle of the water and whatnot. I'm like, okay, now if that smoke or smog or chemical coldness wasn't something that I was inhaling, but could it be something that we were all drinking? Mm-hmm. Like, I know that's a whole nother group.
You got a lot of water right there. You got a water treatment plant right there. Yeah. The stuff is going up. What comes up must come down.
I'm just cycling
the stuff back into the same community. Mm-hmm.
Hey, man.
There's something in the water.
Something in the water. I hear that. And, you know, Usher said this, man. You got it. You got it bad.
Nathaniel did not survive that quote.
I did not. I cracked. Oh, God.
Man. It really asks, how, you know, that's why I believe a lot of faith was in part, please, in Lambert's Point. That, God played a central part in the lives of people in Park Place. Even, you know, if you was Muslim, Park Place was very central for the Islamic community.
It is.
You know, I live right down the street from the mosque. Mm-hmm. And then you had so many churches and so much faith. It was really, that's what we got.
Yep.
Lambert's Point.
More,
you know,
say more about the faith. Like, what did that look like for you?
Now, I can say for myself, but I can speak for these brothers as well. Like, you know, that, like, being, I don't, you know, being having parents, and, you know, that wasn't a common thing in our neighborhood, having both parents in there, first and foremost. And then you put in the church aspect. Well, we're not just going on Easter. We're going, Sunday. It might be a vacation Bible school. Yeah. It might be a Wednesday night Bible study.
Yep.
And we taking some of our friends from the neighborhood with us as well. Your pops had a van, didn't they? We had a van, too. And we would ship all the kids with us, and we going to church as well. So it gave us the faith base was something where it's like, man, you know, this shooting from lead to the cold dust that I don't even see, and I'm drinking this. It's like, but I have like this sense of I know that we're gonna get through.
Hope was prevalent.
Yeah,
like even in a hopeless situation, what feels like a hopeless situation is hope. And somebody told me something one time that kind of just resonates with me. Anytime that you feel like you can't go on, like hope stands for hold on, pain ends.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you feel like, man, this is a lot going on, like I got a lot of these social, emotional issues going on. These, everything's just bad. Like nothing looks good. There's no up from here. But just hold on.
Wow.
Pain ends because it's got to get better.
It's got to.
And that's what faith came into play.
Wow.
You say, you remember like when we were coming out, anytime we go spend a night at another person's house.
Yeah.
Oh, you there Sunday night and you woke up there Sunday morning?
You going
to church. Like you bring your church clothes with you. Tell them to bring his church clothes with him because we're going to church the next day. Oh, mom, we don't care. We're going to church because faith got us through a lot of times. Mm-hmm. I remember, and Malcolm can attest, we were at Upper Bound.
Mm.
It's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to bring my Bible. We're going to make sure we do our devotion. Mm. Before we went to sleep, we're going to make sure we're like purpose-driven life, you know. Mm. And we had our own little thing. Like, we was make sure that we was on it. So it was kind of like, even then, like I said, that was a time spent right there in ODU at Lambert's Point.
Wow.
It was something that was kind of big. Like, you need that because if not, it's a hopeless situation. That's why a lot of people turn to other elements to kind of soothe and try to, you know, cope, you know, the negative things that's going on in their lives. Like, I'm trying to, you know, turn to, you know, drugs or alcohol or something to kind of numb the pain that they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, faith can be a salve. It could be something that's healing, a balm that kind of covers, you know, what's going on inside. It gives you a sense of, I can get through this. And that's what, for me, within the Christian faith, is that death is never the end. Like, when it seems like it's the end, we know there's always a resurrection. There's always something that's positive on the other side of it. And so when we see death around us, of gang violence or drug overdoses or, you know, police brutality, that's not the end. Always something that is always a resurrection on the other end.
So the crazy thing when you're talking about all the different faith-based things, it's like it's funny now because we have all these new words and things that we use for like trauma. You got trauma-informed specialists. You got all these mental health terms. And like we didn't know about trauma or secondary trauma growing up. Like you could see someone having a drug addiction walk down the street.
Mm.
And it's like, even though you're seeing that, you're not traumatized. You could go to school and hear about someone being shot and killed in the community. Yes. No one considered that trauma back then. Like, all the things that we saw, witnessed, or dealt with, there was no words for that. So a lot of times, faith would be the catch-all for mental health, for healing, for service in the communities with food, clothes, all those things, that would be where you would go get your mental health healing before you even knew what mental health was or even understood what it was. So it's like for our community to be flooded with all these different social ills, all these different predatory companies, funeral homes, ABC stores, all these different problems, impoverished, gentrification. Like the only thing that you could find within the community that had a semblance of hope or good was the churches. And then if you had two-parent households and it was a good structured home, because just because you have two parents doesn't always mean it's the best situation.
Yeah, right.
But having the homes that we kind of grew up in, church and home for us was probably the safest and most secure place for your mental health.
Some of them friends. In those communities. The friends used to.
Yeah.
Either be in your yard, somebody, we, it's like, having a family like that and that hope right there is like it invited those that it wasn't normal for them. Like, man, come on, you can come eat on the porch and you're not in the house right now. You have a meal on the porch.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing was, when I visited each one of your houses, it didn't feel any different than my house because y'all had the same structure and the same. That's, like, if I go to your house, your dad was talking to me about faith. Your dad was talking to me about making sure I'm doing what I need to do, asking me about my parents, asking whether or not I had everything I needed. Go to your house, get the same thing. That's like, crazy. That structure and that pillar of support was there in each one of our households, and it just felt safe, it felt comfortable, it felt at home no matter which place I laid my head at or went to go visit.
That's real though. Yeah. That's real. I agree. Right. That's real though. Yeah. That's real. I could definitely go to either one of y'all houses and it's like the same. It's like the same thing. It's like my parents is there, right?
It's gonna be, you're gonna be safe, you can be fed, you can be taken care of.
Yep.
And there's accountability because they're gonna treat you like one of their own.
Yeah.
I think we joked about this the other day. Like, me, if we go say that somebody else's house, they'll put you to work like you're one of their kids. Yeah. Like, I was like, oh, you see me here? Okay, yeah. Go cut the grass. Yeah. And take your little friend with you,
take,
too.
Take your little friend with you. He can help you with the leaves. Uh-huh.
And the crazy thing was, there's never enough food for me to get seconds and the family to get seconds. But when y'all came to the house, there's more than enough food.
You want some more, baby?
And they can go ahead and get some more. Get some and more. I'm looking at my mom with a side eye like, where's this extra food when... When I want something,
bless your family,
right? For real. Your mama biscuits, your mama rolls, yes, sir.
Bless her, man. For real, bro. That's crazy. That is real, man.
Yeah,
that's love, man.
Yeah, yes, sir.
That's real. Oh man, that's peace, y'all.
Did y'all play sports together? In football team?
Well, we were rivals.
More they went to more. I went to Granby. So yeah, we always had
We ran into each other once or twice before. Yeah, yeah.
Hey, you already heard about the police, you know.
I would love to hear that story again.
I know you got some questions, though.
That was what I was gonna ask.
The sports thing, we kind of made a segue too. We didn't even cover the sports, but you said the question was sports. And
more on sports.
Yeah, so. Did you play for Granby?
Yeah, I played for Granby a little bit. Yeah, I wish I went to Moore, though.
We wish you went to Moore. It would have been bad if you went to Moore.
I wish.
Oh, man, I don't think
it was. It's crazy how the streets kind of sent you,
know you
to Granby. And you were dividing up the neighborhood so that you wouldn't have too much of the same population going to the same school.
We all had a plan to wear white tees and blue jeans and Air Force One.
Yes, you did that too?
Yeah, we was supposed to do that in Cole, and everybody was going to go to Moore. Like, we going to go to Moore with the white tees and blue.
And with the Air Force Ones on.
Then they put the district on and they started spreading
us up. What was the strategy behind having everybody wear the same
thing? Just we all on one accord.
We look like
we just
wore a uniform. I don't know.
The
franchise. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I think it was just the image was looking a certain way to certain demographics. And it was like, we live in different neighborhoods, we live in different places, but we wear the same thing. So we're like a unified front. We want to go to the same schools. We want to grow old with the people that we've been going to school with the whole entire time. Went to elementary school and middle school with the same kids, but now you kind of get divided. And it's like coming from that same neighborhood with all those different issues, it's like it's security being with people that you know and you're familiar with.
Yes.
Even though it wasn't the safest community, you feel safe being with people who share a similar experience to you.
Even at 8-11, they'd be like, man, you ever come to jail, bro? We got your back. I don't want to come to jail,
Well, I appreciate the security that you're providing me behind these bars.
I'm good.
8-11 is a local city jail in Norfolk. Me and Malcolm had a few encounters where we had to lock up a few of our former classmates before.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. We both worked at the...
We locked up some?
Well, no,
I didn't lock up.
Hold on. You secured them. I locked them up. So I was a Norfolk Circuit Court deputy clerk. So I had to swear in people and process their jail paperwork and send them over to the jail. So as they're getting convicted, like, I would process the paperwork. So a lot of times I'm swearing in people that I went to school with. Like, you got charged for a felony for selling drugs. You got charged for, you know, having gun possession.
What was that like?
The saddest thing in the world, because this is someone that I share crayons with, and now I'm writing their sentence to jail. It's, you don't know how close you are to having that exact same story. Like, they say, like, based off the district that you live in, it determines whether or not you're going to end up going to jail or not. It's called the school-to-prison pipeline. So knowing that, oh, man, I was in the same school system that you were in, and I was living in the same areas that you were living in, and you're going in a completely different route than I'm going, and I'm one mistake away from being in the exact same situation that you're in. So for me, seeing that, it was, I got used to seeing people who look like me from the same area that I was from going to the area, going to jail or going to the penitentiary. It's probably one of the saddest things that I experienced. And it's probably the reason why I didn't go to law school, because that was the goal and the aim. You don't know how close you are to having that exact same story. It's probably one of the saddest things that I experienced. And it's probably the reason why I didn't go to law school, because that was the goal and the aim. But for me, it was like, I can't, it was soul killing, because they all had the same story. They came from broken families. They were in bad schools. They were surrounded by violence and guns and all these different things that were negative to their environment. And then they succumbed to that environment. And I'm like, okay, man, like, that could have easily been me. Mm. And it's like, we were one mistake.
And you didn't actually have to be committing a crime if you were standing around the wrong place at the wrong time, wrong area. Like he was saying, there was an ice cream truck looking van and there's a raid. If you're in that house just visiting a friend at that time, you could have been caught up in something that you absolutely had nothing to do with. So I can understand that. Your terminology just... it was a soul gut punch, because, like, I didn't lock it in.
No, you did. Like, you were a sheriff. You were a deputy sheriff. You literally had to secure the facilities, and people that you went to school with were in there.
You're a probation officer, weren't you?
Yes. Wow. Yes. But I never... It's weird that I compartmentalized it as a job, trying to take care of my family and trying to provide the things that I provided. Like, I removed myself from the system that was incarcerating and all that. So I was there doing a job, and obviously I did my job. I secured, made sure no one escaped, and made sure nothing crazy happened. But at the same time, it's a conundrum to be in that facility and to kind of characterize yourself with a system that's degrading and feels like it's hurting your people. So I was like, I was there. But my time there, I spent motivating people, having conversations to uplift people, helping, encouraging people to get their GED. So, yes, I was there. I was closing the cell. I had the uniform on and all that. But while I was in this place that was definitely a form of secondary trauma for me, coming and seeing people who looked like me behind bars every day, I didn't see it that way. And, yes, by definition, yes, I was definitely the person closing that gate and kind of sealing your fate and telling you I'm helping to secure the system of justice that says you're supposed to be in here. But I had to kind of psychologically remove myself from thinking that I was a part of it in order to survive it, because seeing someone in a cage is just as traumatic as being in the cage. And, like, obviously anyone who's been in a jail cell will definitely not tell you that. But I have to watch someone that looks like me every day use the restroom in front of me, fight in there, eat in there, sleep in there, be deprived of their family, walk around, and the mood of that whole facility is depression. The smell of it, the different mannerisms, the survival you have to put on to survive in there as a inmate is similar to the survival that you had to put on as a deputy to live in there, because at any point a fight could pop off and no one cares if you got a uniform. If anything, that uniform makes you even more of a threat. So you're going to catch it too. So it's like being in a facility where all these things are happening, it's like a psychological traumatic warehouse. And it's like, I'm there, I'm opening and shutting doors, I'm taking people to the dentist and all that, but I never really saw myself as a part of the institution that was doing it.
You don't know how close you are to having that exact same story. It's probably one of the saddest things that I experienced. And it's probably the reason why I didn't go to law school, because that was the goal and the aim. But for me, it was like, I can't, it was soul killing.
I just saw it as, my family got to eat. This place is paying a little bit more, and I'm going to do my best and try to pour into people while I was there. I don't know if there's a possible way to make the best out of that situation, or even to kind of stand in the mirror and tell yourself that you're working for a facility, an institution that's continuously locking up a good portion of people you grew up with. But it's like you got to psychologically trick yourself and try to find some good, or try to pour something into people while you're there to kind of make up for the heart transplant you need for delivering this fate to people who just might have made the wrong choice to make sure their family could eat too.
You said it all. I think we did the best that we could with what we were working with, and I think that's ours were the same. I think we were looking to go into the legal field, to law, for the right reasons to help people. And then every instance of what we were doing was about auditing the law and figuring out how we can get into the system and correct it. Mm-hmm. And so even in those parts that we were playing within the criminal justice system, knowing like, okay, this is part of it, but it was a job.
Yeah.
And you had to put in that, those blinders, and had to put yourself
safeguards.
In the safeguard yourself, like to say, okay, this is not really happening. When it is completely happening, you can't get emotional thinking about it. It's like, I'm sitting here, I had to listen to cases about rape, gun violence, murder, drugs being sold in the community. You gotta act like you're not hearing it, that you're not seeing it, that you're not seeing two separate families, one being the victim, one being the defendant, and they're both gonna leave being upset because it's really, the justice doesn't really feel like justice. It just feels like more harm. Mm-hmm. You see that continually, and then you continue to move throughout the docket.
Yeah.
As a deputy clerk, it was 20 of those cases, mm-hmm. and it just continued to repeat itself.
Yeah.
And they all look like you, and they all look good with you, and they all live in the same area as you.
And the craziest thing was, yes, some of those people made horrible decisions and ultimately got the time that they got because of a bad decision. But it's like when they're going through this person's history, because they run through the person's mental health history and their social history, their background,
the pre-sentence report,
demographic information in the pre-sentencing report. Like, you see how many times the system failed
every time.
Child, hearing about people being taken out of the home from CPS, hearing about the kids being homeless, hearing about kids.
Physical abuse, sexual abuse,
all these different things. And it's like, if someone might have interrupted this trauma and the things that this kid was dealing with, would they have made the decision they're making today? And obviously people have to account for decisions they make, but it's like there were so many people that failed this kid, so many programs that weren't there, so many people that failed this kid. It's like they need to all be here too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you need to go and do what you need to do to make up and atone for what you did, but like those people should be here too.
Yep.
There's a lot of people that dropped the ball for you to get to where you went and be where you are.
And that was the humbling part about being in that role where you put your right hand up, repeat after me, I do solemnly swear. And it's a mirror reflection of yourself, because you're saying it to somebody that you can easily switch places with them.
Definitely.
And you're one program away from that person not being in the same seat that you switching seats, right? One upper bound away, one learning bridge away, one breakthrough program away, one Boys and Girls Club away, one YMCA away, one visit to church with a friend away from that situation being switched.
There was literally people that we played football with that are no longer living, and some are in jail because it's like we were on the same team, had the same coach pouring into us, all these different things, but maybe because I had two parents in the household, I had a little bit more structure, I'm not in the position you're in. And then even still, just the police situation that we're about to talk about, like, we were all in a nice-looking car on either Friday or Saturday night, like, just trying to enjoy ourselves, and got profiled. And if we had handled that situation the wrong way, all of us could potentially have a charge leaving that situation.
Dead or in jail. Either way, it just could have went differently.
There is really nothing that removes us from the path that some of our friends and people that we grew up with, other than grace, luck, and some blessings.
Right.
For real, I always think about the favor of the Lord. Yep. You know, my grandmother, my mother, or, you know, I didn't know I do this with my kids now, but my mom used to just pray over us every day before we left the house. Yep,
same here.
She, like, I'm like, okay, mom. I mean, I do it with my children now, but it's like, man,
that's understand that now.
Yeah, I understand. Like, you know, I can't, like me and my son, I mean, I can't, if somebody's shooting over there around the school or whatnot, I can't just jump from Virginia Beach from work or something and go, if I'm at a band or something, I can't just go. So I got to cover them with something, some faith, some prayer, you know. So that's why I like a lot of that faith come in the picture. And like you said, you just once, we... Say if we went around that corner or we could have did something weird.
Made somebody make them feel nervous or something and kind of put the setting of what was happening. We were, me, Malcolm, D'Angelo, and I believe my brother was also in the car at the time. We was coming from MacArthur Mall right across the street from where we're at now, from the movies that day. It was all, I don't know what we came, what to go see, but it was 4th of July. It had to be 2007.
Neither of you remember what you were watching
before. I think that experience is the only thing I remember from that day. I didn't
that
even
was
remember,
like a movie.
I didn't even remember that it was July 4th.
Yeah, no.
But that moment, every conversation, every single thing that everyone else was doing in the car, I can remember that like it happened an hour ago. But what we did before that, nothing else is imprinted.
Kind of sucked
brain.
The fun out of it because it was a good time. Like it was in the mall. Talking to girls, watching movies, supposed to be Independence Day, coming from north of the Portsmouth to my apartment that I lived with my parents, coming back from summer break. I was taking a summer class at Norfolk State at the time, you know, and...
You was at Morehouse at the time?
Morehouse at the time, but I was at Norfolk State for taking summer classes.
Okay, yeah.
You know...
And Malcolm, you were at Norfolk State?
Yeah, I was at Norfolk State at the time. And I think you were at Norfolk State at the time.
Yeah, either Norfolk State or here. I probably started going to Norfolk
State. It was 2007.
When you say here, you mean the
TCC, Tidewater Community College.
Yeah. So coming down the street and I'm going to the tunnel, I'm a fairly new driver. I wasn't really driving at that time, but I guess my lights were off or not all the way on. Like maybe my park lights were on something.
No, your lights were on.
Well, yeah. Not on.
Because
you
could see it in the dashboard that the lights were on.
So I pulled up to the light. Saw a cop car and I walked right past it. And as we're going through the stoplight, like stopping at the stoplight, sitting there for a while, leaving. So there's no speeding. Next thing you know, a cop car comes behind us and I'm seeing in my rear view and they turn on the lights. So I'm like, okay, clearly they're not pulling me over because I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not speeding. I didn't have to change the lane. I'm in my right lane. So I'm like, okay, cool. Well, as my parents have taught us, anytime you see a cop car pull up beside you, you get to the right lane. So I moved to the right lane and let them try to get out of the way. And they kept behind me. I said, oh, they must be trying to get around me to make a turn. So I make a right turn. Well, they made the right turn behind me. I was like, okay, well, clearly this is for me. So I pulled into a 7-Eleven parking lot because I don't know what happened if it was on a darker street. Yeah. I look up next and over, surrounded by 3 police cars. And they're just grilling us, like, what are you doing here? Where are you guys coming from? Give me all your IDs out the car. What illegal substances do you have in here? Do you have any guns in here? What is that in your console right there? And I'm like, that's sugar. I had coffee this morning. Like, that's residue from that. He's like, oh, no, that looks like weed residue. Would you mind? They called me out the car and grilled me about, you know, do I drink? Do you like moonshine? I heard you know, what's going on? And eventually it got to the point where he asked me, he's like, well, if you ain't been smoking weed, you wouldn't mind taking a piss test right now. And like, there's a Rite Aid right up the street. You can have you piss in the cup. And that's when I realized that the people are like, oh, this is not getting any better. It's only getting worse. Mm-hmm. And I had to explain to him, like, I'm a college student. My friend is a college student. My other friend is a college student. We're all part of the Upper Bound program. You know, I'm here. Those residue that's in that console, that's coffee grounds.
Like, we even had pocket constitutions at the time. Mm-hmm. And was talking about our rights and the fact that we felt like our rights were being violated. You're not telling us what the issue was. You said it was the lights and the dashboard. He wasn't the strongest driver at the time. So he's believing it. But I see his dashboard. I had been driving longer than him. The lights are clearly on. Mm. Like, I know you can take it to certain levels, but the lights were in a way that you knew the lights outside was on. And they didn't say it was like a taillight out or something. They just said it was off. So I was like,
that's me having coffee from going to a summer class. Yeah. And right now you're offending me. And I'm taking offense to that. And that's when you take a step back and you realize, oh, I misassessed this entire situation.
But he didn't even leave because he assessed the situation wrong. He had got a call that something else was going on, and he vacated the scene. So that was grace. Like, we even had pocket constitutions at the time and was talking about our rights and the fact that we felt like our rights were being violated, because I don't know what direction. Like, we tried everything in our power to get out of the situation in a civil way. Things were not adding up. So it's like, without him being called, them being called to another scene or something, they were called to, they needed backup. And that was the only thing that got us out of that situation. Because with the pocket constitutions,
that pocket constitution meant nothing to them.
And as strong as we felt with it, we did not feel strong at all. This was survival. It wasn't even a, I'm trying to be proud that I got a pocket constitution. I was searching through that thing to find something to explain to you. Running down your full resume of who you are and what you've done. Like, please don't let me be.
Fourth Amendment, illegal search and seizure.
Running down your full resume of who you are and what you've done, feeling like you had to run down your whole life story in order to tell someone that you're not whoever you thought we were. And it even feels degrading to ourselves to have to explain that what you thought we were is even what you think it is. It's like, you're making this mindset up. You're making these thoughts up about what you think this certain group of people are. So it's just, it's pitiful. And as courageous as I felt back then when we did it, it's as degrading now to even think that we had to even do that much. Because we all had to give up our ID, like two people in the back seat that weren't even driving.
I'm understanding, like, what are you talking about?
They weren't even driving. And then just kind of looking in the back of the car to see if those individuals had anything. I think even when he came to your brother, he was saying he recognized your brother and this, that, and the third. And it's like, you didn't recognize anyone in the car. Yeah. It's like, you're trying to really fish for anything that you had. And I don't know what your experience was in the car, but I know everyone was feeling a little anxious and feeling a lot of anxiety.
Just trying to sit still and make sure I'm not doing no crazy movement, man. You know, and I thought y'all was like some heroes, man, pulling out pocket constitutions and stuff. Like,
shout out to Mr. JR. Mr. TJ gave me that.
These cats they really fighting justice system right now.
Like, even though you saw us as courageous, it's like we were looking for lines of life to make sure we got out of the situation safe and make sure y'all got out of that situation safe.
Please help me.
And it's crazy that all those laws in that book and nothing saved us but somebody calling and having them go to another location.
Hey, man, I heard no offense to him, but I heard a police officer say, you know the biggest gang in Norfolk is? Us. And I said, God dang. Really?
I believe it.
Okay, I got you, brother. I was just trying to sit still in the back, man. I won't try to move. I won't try to give him no reason to do nothing crazy, man. Just.
But it's crazy how anxiety and nervousness looks like criminal activity. Mm-hmm. Like, just being scared that you may not make it out of a situation because you really didn't do anything to someone else. Their perspective was, there must be something that I'm missing. That's and evidence. I need to figure out what it is so I can get these four individuals off the street.
I was in my backyard and I was looking across the street. I seen a Uber lady, white Uber lady or something. Like a delivery, Uber Foods or something. Uber Eats, yeah. So she missed the house because the house was right next to her, but she pulled in somebody's driveway and she just was parking. And I was like, and my heart was like, oh, man. But she got out, and this is white lady. I was like, man, and think about, you know, the past stories that somebody pulling up in somebody's wrong driveway and getting shot and killed, or somebody knocking on the wrong door to deliver something and getting shot and killed for their color. And I was like, it made it kind of tear come from my eyes. So I was like, this lady's probably not going to experience this. I mean, you know what I mean? And it's sad to say that she feels so comfortable with just parking there talking, thanks for my tip, you know, and moseying back to her car. And I'm just like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
Like,
you got to second guess every movement that you make.
That's what I tell my kid about. Like, I never try to get in nobody's driveway. Yeah. Remember, you used to make a wrong turn, you pull in the body and drive.
I'm a
reverse
man. That's crazy because I did Uber Eats with one of my cousins the other day, and it was nighttime, and I went and rung the doorbell, and then I took 3 steps back.
Mm. Oh my god!
Stepped to the side into where the side window was to make sure they see. Held my hands up with the bag in clear view sight. It's you don't even realize you're doing these second guesses. And doing all these things.
I used to do that all the time when I was canvassing. It was like, you try to do something for the public good, like get people to vote. You're knocking on doors, like, same thing, 3 steps back, like smiling with the biggest smile, even though it's hot as crap outside. Like, hey, I am
not here to rob you. I'm not here to break in.
You want to vote? Like, you try to wear like the least unassuming clothes, and like they kind of make it like I had like that. Like I was wearing.
I am a bird. I watch birds.
I'm a bird watcher.
Bird watch. I got binoculars. That's what I do. I don't have any tattoos.
I'm
on safe. Me.
I got my cargo shorts on.
Come on, man. I remember being
the cargo short is some fairies.
I called the police on the ODU police before, man. For real, man. He told us, he said he smelled something at the water. I'm like, man, is everybody doing that, man? It ain't us. He get to my homies and my roommate at the time at the dormitory. And then he tell us to stop. I'm like, he ain't talking to us. We kept walking. He said, stop or I'm going to stun you. I was like, Jesus, man. All right, I'll stop. He said, well, look, turn around. Lift up your shirt. I just want to see if you got any tattoos. Any tattoos?
You love tattoos?
Yeah,
you
just want to
check,
man.
You want to check and see if I
can. Life, right?
So, my friend was a little bit more rebellious on it. So, he got my friend. He told him to put his hands behind his back and put the, not the actual cuffs, but the little
zip ties.
Zip ties.
Yeah.
Put the zip ties on him and put him in an ODU car.
No.
Must love the ODU.
No love the ODU.
That part was just ODU for upward bound.
No, but ODU police is OD sometimes.
Yeah, he was. I called. This is the only time I called the police.
You called the police on the police?
I called the police on the police. Police, I think the ODU police kidnapped my friend and they dropped him off at a gas station.
Oh, no.
Yeah, on Hampton Boulevard, man.
That's illegal.
Illegal search and seizure.
Due process.
Like, everything, all right.
Holding somebody without
But what does it matter reasons? When they got the power, man? And so it's like, I don't know, man.
I'm sorry, Adrian.
Maybe was smoking.
Good. We're doing great.
Maybe. And that's why, you know, who knows if that coal dust is affecting the law enforcement over there.
Old to you.
It might be messing with their mentality. God bless y'all, man. But, you know, maybe we need to help out. Maybe it's not just the impoverished community. Maybe it's the law enforcement as well, man. I don't know. Everybody taking in this air.
Well, there's a lot of businesses and a lot of other entities out there as well. So maybe definitely, and those entities are part of the community, so they could be impacted as well.
Like, yeah, he looked crazy in the eyes. I was like, he may be eating the cold, man. This dude here.
So we have like 15 minutes left. Okay. We've covered everything that I wanted to talk about. But is there anything that's like sort of lingering or things that you wanted to bring up?
Absolutely. That's one thing. Billy mentioned this one thing. He said, I lived in Norfolk my whole life, and then I lived in Cali for a little bit. Mm. What you doing, Cali?
Oh, man, I was on this show. With BET, man. Dang. Oh, man. Dang, brother. He done set me up with the alley, man. It was a show called The Next Big Thing. And, you know, Nipsey Hussle was up there. I ain't never meet that brother. I wish I stayed for the next episode. I was eliminated about, like, 5 episodes in.
You made it.
Yeah, but I made it in there, man. And it was a cool experience being over there. It was bittersweet.
Hold on, who's the judges? Who's the judges up there?
Dame Dash, Tina Davis, and Zaytoven.
Okay.
You know, they kind of tried to picture me as a single dad, and I was like, nah, man, I got a lady, man. She taking care of my baby right now. You know, they try to crump her out.
It was a story to create drama around the stakes.
So can we watch you?
It's on
BT Plus.
BT Plus. Man, thanks, brother.
And you can check it out on YouTube as well.
Yeah. And it's cool, but you know, it was a blessing in it for getting eliminated because that when I got eliminated, I had to go back home. My son was just born. He was about 4 days old when I went to California. So you know, that was bittersweet. My wife was taking it the worst, but God bless her. She made it through. But when I got eliminated, I got sent to DJ Jazzy Jeff house and his famous thing called the Playlist Retreat, where you got Moonchild, you know, Xavier Omar, DJ Scratch, Kid Capri.
That's when you got eliminated?
Yes. Yes. Wow. Yeah. I mean,
what a consolation prize.
What? Right. That was like, come on, man. I went to Curtis Bethany's wedding, and I made it back for his wedding, and the next week I went over there to Jazzy Jeff's house, and then me and my wife, we got married on my son's first birthday, and then boom, we went to Paris.
Come Barcelona. On. Man.
Boom. There we go.
So you're saying that elimination can lead to
Promotions.
My brother. That's crazy. That's the
key that you guys should take out of this. Okay. Whenever you feel eliminated, there's hope.
That's it.
So I did want to talk about another thing. Billy should have talked about his music career too and the different projects he's doing now. So I'll let him come back in. But in terms of one thing I do want to leave people with, a lot of impoverished communities where people are in the paycheck to paycheck mindset and they're thinking about so many different things. It's like all around the country, a lot of times because you don't fit a certain tax bracket, a lot of things are allowed to go on for long periods of times in those communities. A lot of those communities are near or the site for dumping trash, the site for other environmental chemicals and things that are dangerous. So this thing that's going on in Lambert's Point and in Newport News, while we care about it more because it's happening right here, there's a big thing going on in a bunch of different areas and a bunch of different communities where because they're impoverished and don't meet a certain tax bracket, they don't take as serious their say, but also people don't really think so much about where these things are going and how they might impact those people because of their tax bracket. So as important as Lambert's Point is and Newport News and the things that are going on related to coal dust there, I do want it to become a larger conversation about environmental justice, especially in areas that's impacting those impoverished communities that don't even recognize that this is a threat to health and their safety and their security and their mental health and all those different things. Because there's probably a lot of more people in different communities that don't even know that the coal dust or the nuclear plant that's nearby or whatever environmental issue that's nearby could be having an impact on their water, on their health, on their air, on just their quality of life. So just want to kind of touch on that while we were there.
That's good. I also want to highlight the fact that Billy isn't a rookie to environmental justice or even green living. I think you had did something with WHRO or PBS or something like that. What was that again?
Oh man, thank you, brother. They called Green Beats.
Yeah.
Bless it.
No, my son loves it. I have to say it.
Bless him, man. Bless for a legend, man.
And what is Green Beans?
Green Beats. It was
Green Beats.
It was a show with WHRO. They had a cool funding program, and it was with this young lady named Sky. She does a lot of music with her ukulele. You probably seen her around somewhere. And she wrote this song and played on a ukulele called Growing, like growing your own crops and whatnot. And it was, oh, 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 you want to see how flowers grow? corn and beans, tomatoes, potato, all come from the ground. So it's just basically like, you know, teaching you how to grow your own type of food. And it was a cartoon that I was featured in that they can still see on PBS Kids and whatnot. So, man, you know, thanks, brother.
It's so cool. I promise you. It's a little cartoon Billy up there. I sure will. It's a cartoon Billy up there. I'm like, my son, like, Uncle Billy right there. He said, yes.
Hey, he gives yeah. him a
oh, I think I said Destiny in the video.
No,
I
man.
I have to see the
Come
video
on,
of him dancing
man.
To it.
Bless you, brother. Hey, man, and like I said, I admire these Malcolm Jones and Nathaniel Curtis. I admire these brothers so much. I have so much admiration for these brothers, man. Like, the knowledge that they have, you know, He'll knock you out. He can pray for you too. So I love that. It's brother the same way, man. It's like, you know, we don't want to start no trouble, but we with you and we gonna ride with you. And it's yeah. always been yeah. community based, people first. You know, pray first.
Come on now, and pray off the baby.
Come on, pray off. So man, much love, man. And even this opportunity to get to talk to you, Adrian, I'm grateful for. And these cats always, like, you know, keep me in the loop or plug me in to try to, like, you know, just when you say, man, what am I doing in the world? And these guys would call you up like, man, here's your ticket to do something great for the world, you know, yeah. to tell a story or to help in some way. So I yeah. appreciate y'all, man.
Well, it's crazy because we would always pass the torch to each other. Like, mm-hmm. we worked at several jobs together. Mm-hmm. We've been Six a part of similar community things. Like, it's like we always, and then once one of us gets something, we're always looking back, turning yes. back, mm-hmm. and passing that opportunity to another person. So, yeah, it's crazy wow. to think about all the things, similar life experiences that we've had.
Wow, man.
A lot of overlap. Like, what's it, Six of Stones, Upward Bound. Mm. What else is it?
Community
of schools, yeah. a repair lab, wow. circuit court, man.
Playing football together, yeah. Doing music together yeah. at my house.
On the oh, yeah.
We used to get haircuts. Malcolm used to do our shape ups.